Williamson shrugged. "That's up to your captain, and your sergeant, and the captain of Earth's Hope, and Hope's logistic computer. We just don't have enough data yet to project a course of action for you. It may be a long and bloody battle. It may be just a case of walking in to pick up the pieces. Conceivably, the Taurans might want to make a peace offer." Cortez snorted. "In which case, you would simply be part of our muscle, our bargaining power." He looked at Cortez mildly. "No one can say for sure." The orgy that night was amusing, but it was like trying to sleep in the middle of a raucous beach party. The only area big enough to sleep all of us was the dining hall. They draped a few bed sheets here and there for privacy, then unleashed Stargate's 18 sex-starved men on our women, compliant and promiscuous by military custom and law, but desiring nothing so much as sleep on solid ground. The 18 men acted as if they were compelled to try as many permutations as possible, and their performance was impressive, in a strictly quantitative sense, that is. Those of us who were keeping count led a cheering section for some of the more gifted members. I think that's the right word. The next morning, and every other morning we were on Stargate 1, we staggered out of bed and into our suits to go outside and work on the new wing. Eventually, Stargate would be tactical and logistical headquarters for the war, with thousands of permanent personnel guarded by a half-dozen heavy cruisers in Hope's class. When we started, it was 2 shacks and 20 people. When we left, it was 4 shacks and 20 people. The work was hardly work at all compared to Darkside, since we had plenty of light and got 16 hours inside for every 8 hours work, and no drone attack for a final exam. When we shuttled back up to the Hope, nobody was too happy about leaving, though some of the more popular females declared it'd be good to get some rest. Stargate was the last easy, safe assignment we'd have before taking up arms against the Taurans. And as Williamson had pointed out the first day, there was no way of predicting what that would be like. Most of us didn't feel too enthusiastic about making a collapsar jump either. We'd been assured that we wouldn't even feel it happen, just free fall all the way. I wasn't convinced. As a physics student, I'd had the usual courses in general relativity and theories of gravitation. We only had a little direct data at that time. Stargate was discovered when I was in grade school. But the mathematical model seemed clear enough. The collapsar Stargate was a perfect sphere, about 3 kilometers in radius. It was suspended forever in a state of gravitational collapse that should have meant its surface was dropping toward its center at nearly the speed of light. Relativity propped it up, at least gave it the illusion of being there. The way all reality becomes illusory and observer-oriented when you study general relativity, or Buddhism, or get drafted. At any rate, there would be a theoretical point in space-time when one end of our ship was just above the surface of the collapsar and the other end was 1 kilometer away in our frame of reference. In any sane universe, this would set up tidal stresses and tear the ship apart, and we would be just another 1,000,000 kilograms of degenerate matter on the theoretical surface, rushing headlong to nowhere for the rest of eternity, or dropping to the center in the next 1,000,000,000th of a second. You pays your money, and you takes your frame of reference. But they were right. We blasted away from Stargate 1, made a few course corrections, and then just dropped for about 1 hour. Then a bell rang, and we sank into our cushions under a steady 2 gravities of deceleration. We were in enemy territory.